Okay, here we go. So I'll give a Blackboard talk, and this is intended. So I try to bridge somewhat, give you a somewhat different angle at the quantum marginal problem, at the quantum marginal problem in the sense that Alexander Kwiatkow and also Alan Knudsen talked about it, but a little different angle and spin on it, and I hope to bridge the sort of mathematics side with the quantum information intuition, tell you what we can say from quantum information about it. So I want to start with something that has nothing to do with the marginal problem. Just let me give you a short outline. I want to first present a quantum information problem, like a very natural problem, which is spectrum estimation. Then I want to give you a very natural solution in terms of a group theory, and this will be the connecting point to the lectures we had in the beginning of the week. And this then will be, this solution will be our tool. And this tool we want to apply or to learn something about the marginal problem. People that know me, I probably talked about this a few years ago, so there are some new spins on this third part, so I hope not everyone's will be bored. Then there is, for the people that are bored, I have a little homework for this hour, namely, you can try to figure out why Horn's problem is actually a special case of the marginal problem. Okay? So, and I'll explain that at the end of the lecture. But for the people who have some spare capacity in the meantime, special case of marginal problem. So I think Alexander Kwiatkow mentioned this about 3 years ago to me, and sort of in the beginning of the week I figured out how it works. So this is all a joint work with Graham Richardson and also with Aram Harrow. So let's start. So we're going to do this first part, spectrum estimation. So we imagine, just like in Renato's talk, we have a source that spits out particles. And we have n particles. And because we have this nice Definetti theorem, we will just assume that they are in a tensor product state. And the density matrix therein is rho. So that's a qubit. So state is living on a d-dimensional Hilbert space. And we can ask the question, what is the spectrum of rho? Okay. How are we going to do it? If you're a quantum information man, you're going to take these n particles and you're going to measure them with some measurement device. So you put up some box here and you perform some measurement, and that measurement will give you, let me call this spectrum of rho R. So R, right, clearly is a vector in RD, we'll also denote it by this, it's a decreasing list of numbers. So we put some measurement up here, we get some outcome R hat with some probability, of course, if the measurement is a good measurement, then we will have the property that that the probability that our measurement gives the wrong outcome, so say the distance between these two is kind of bounded away from zero, that this goes to zero as n goes to infinity. Okay, then we would say the measurement has succeeded. we have a good procedure. Now observe that there is a fairly trivial procedure that will already give you an exponential convergence, namely in that you just start estimating, you just do tomography and you estimate each particle separately. So you estimate this separately and so on, and then you will actually estimate the entire density matrix, and so in particular you can compute the spectrum, and this here will already converge. But fine, okay, so we could do that. But the question that Kyle and Werner were asking is, what is the optimal measurement? So what's the measurement that has the best error exponent? And I won't nag too much about this error exponent being optimal and so on. Let's just think about what is like the optimal way. And in order to do that, let's look what is a measurement. So in general, a measurement, we consider a measurement to be some set of positive operators that sum to the identity on the entire space. So I should say that all n particles are measured at the same time, right? So they all go into this machine and then the outcome comes out. So we have this this measurement operators here, and and the probability rule is that the probability for observing r hat when given rho tensor n is given by the trace of rho tensor n, and then e r hat. Okay. So that clearly is a positive number, and it also sums to 1 because I have this normalization condition. So this would be a general measurement. But now we have some symmetry in the problem, so we can try to use that symmetry to simplify our measurement operators. And so what is the first symmetry that springs to mind? Well, the first symmetry is this permutation invariance. Right? So first, clearly, it shouldn't matter. Clearly, the density matrix that comes in, this rho tensor n, is invariant under permutations. So I should be able to carry this over to my density to my measurement operators and make them permutation invariant too. But then also, I don't actually care about the density matrix itself. I only care about the spectrum. So my operator should also be somehow invariant under the choice of the spectrum. So really, I have two invariances here, so that brings us. So I have two. So I have two actions, right? So I have two natural actions on this tensor space, and one action is the action that just permutes the particles, and I have the other action that sort of rotates the particles, and let me use Allen's notation like this, and if you want, the symmetric group acts here, and the unitary group acts here. And it's easy to see that the two actions commute.
I mean, you said the other invariance was the choice of spectrum. That wasn't quite what you meant.
Oh, I meant the choice of basis.
The choice
of spectrum. Sorry. So spectrum. We want to estimate the spectrum, but actually, you know, yeah, whatever basis we should get the optimal outcome. So we have the symmetry of choosing the basis here, and the unitary group acts on all each particles in the same way. And so it's embedded once. So if they have these two symmetries on here, they commute. And then there is this nice theorem by Schur and Weil, called Schur-Weil duality, that this space breaks up into the following way. So it breaks up into a direct sum of spaces where the unitary group acts here. I'm not so good at this. So the unitary group acts here, and where the symmetric group acts on this space. And the lambdas, these here are so-called Young diagrams. Okay. So these are our lambda, and because we have a d-dimensional space and we have n of these particles, our lambda will have the number of boxes in this lambda will be n, and the number of rows will be d, the maximum number of rows, there may be less. So so these are the Young diagrams that label this thing and correspond one-to-one to the irreducible representations that appear here. And the remarkable thing about this thing is not that we have such a decomposition, it's that these guys here are paired up the same way. So there's not a sum over lambda and lambda prime, and they go over different lambda, but they're paired up, and they each appear once. Each pair just appears once in this decomposition. Okay. So okay, let's do a little example. Consider dimension equal to 2. So what is a generic diagram in dimension 2? Looks like this. Well, the boxes should have equal size. A few more here. Okay. So I don't know what that is. So 6, 2, 4, 5, n is 11. Okay. So the first row, so this lambda is a vector, as you saw, so that's my lambda. So the first row I will denote with length lambda 1, and the second row with lambda 2. So lambda is lambda 1, comma lambda 2. And the one is bigger than lambda 2. So what does this space look like? So what does u lambda look like, corresponding to this diagram? Well, it actually is the span of the following vectors, namely I will forget about normalization. So right here here it's here this is lambda 2. So we have lambda 2 of these singlets. So this here kind of corresponds to a singlet. So lambda 2 of these singlets. And then we can tensor this, and you've seen this a little bit in Robert's talk, that that we have several possibilities here. So we can have all, there's all zeros, or there's one one, the rest zeros. Okay, and so on. So here we have two ones and permutations of that, and so on up to the last one. Looks like this. Okay, so this here will actually be the this will be the subspace of U lambda. Okay, so what do we recognize? Well, if we forget about that for the moment, this here looks like a representation of SU2. Okay. And representations of SU2, I think this is sometimes called Dicker states, or I don't know how these things are all called. But this representation here is a representation of SU2, and the spin that we can associate to this representation is actually lambda 1 minus lambda 2 half. Right? You can think about that. So really, the difference here corresponds to our very familiar spin that we learn in any quantum mechanics class. So these U lambdas are nothing else, for d equals 2, they're nothing else but our very famous familiar spin, just tensored together with a few singlets. And then, what is the V lambda? Well, the V lambda is when you start permuting these things around, right? So we have this permutation action going. So we can permute this dimension V lambda times around. So there are dimension V lambda copies of this representation in our tensor space. Okay, so what else? Let's figure out something more about this representation. Namely, let's figure out what its dimension is. So, it's clear. U lambda has dimension 2j plus 1, right? So it's lambda 1 minus lambda 2 plus 1. Right? Lambda 1 minus lambda 2 plus 1 is certainly smaller than n plus 1, right? Because lambda 1 is smaller than n. And then I subtract something. Okay, that's good. And what about the dimension of this symmetric group there? So what about, so this here is dimension of U lambda. What about dimension V lambda? Well, dimension V lambda is how often times I can bring this guy into how often I can permute it around to sit still inside that space. So how many copies are there? Well, it's maybe not entirely obvious, but you can see that there's some easy upper bound. So you can you can think of a drawing lambda 1, so n choose lambda 1, sort of drawing lambda 1 balls, and then, that's not completely obvious, but drawing lambda 1 balls out of this, so you can see that how often can I bring this into that space that it still sits, that it gives me different copies, okay, and you'll find this upper bound. Good. What? Where it is, so that goes here. So I have, so my this U lambda 1 really looks like, it looks like singlet tensor, singlet tensor, singlet tensor, singlet, and then familiar spin space. Okay, so we have these bounds. They're very nice. So we can use Stirling's approximation to this, and you can show that this is smaller than 2 to the, right? So this is just n factorial things, you know, n factorial, lambda 1 factorial. So if we bring this out, we can show this is n times, minus n times the sum over lambda I log lambda I, where I have normalized these lambda I's, so where lambda I bar is lambda I divided by n. Okay, that's a little exercise. This exponent here, so let me bring this minus sign in here. This exponent here is just the Shannon entropy of these normalized guys. Right? So it's basically you take this diagram and then you divide it by n, so you rescale it all. So you get, of course, not integers anymore. You rescale it, you divide it by n, you get a set of numbers that is decreasing, and that that sums up to 1. Yeah, I use base 2 log. Yeah, you can also interpret the 2 as an e. Okay, that's what Hayashi would do. Right? So what else do we do? Good. So this holds in general. So I told you that dim u lambda is smaller than n plus 1, dim v lambda is smaller than that. So if we do a general dk, okay, for d general, the dimension of u lambda is smaller than the polynomial in n, and the dimension of v lambda is smaller than 2 to the n times the Shannon entropy of the diagram. Okay, that's really nice. I mean, there's one more thing to say. Good, so we said that, so okay, now we know how this space looks like, so let's go back to our operator. So we have understood that space now, and this dimension here is pretty small, this here is pretty big, and it grows with the Shannon entropy. So let's understand what an operator on that space looks like when it commutes with the action of both groups. And we know by Shor's lemma that if you have an operator, when you have an operator that commutes with the action of that group, and you're on an irreducible space, then it is proportional to the identity. We also know that for the symmetric group. So if something inside here commutes with this entire with this entire part here, and it has support only here, then it will be proportional to the identity in that subspace, so proportional to this projector. And if there's support on the whole thing, then the only choice that I have is giving it different weights on different of these subspaces. So E R hat can be written as a sum over E lambda r hat projector onto that space, where these are real numbers, and in our case, because we have a positive operator, they're positive numbers. So now everyone in quantum information probably sees immediately that there's no merit to choose these E's with like some numbers here, right? The best thing to do, if this is your, if your optimal measurement has a symmetry, is just to measure these operators directly, just each single one of them, and then process the data to simulate the data you would have gotten if you had measured this projector. Because it's kind of, it gives you more information to measure P lambda. So we already know what the optimal solution is. So measure these P lambda, right? That's the optimal solution. And you can make this precise in other ways, but I think this is a nice way to see it. So the only thing that we haven't figured out is which lambda goes to which r hat. Right? So for each r hat, we now have to choose a lambda that corresponds to it. So when our, so now we do this measurement. Let me see if I have it still up here. So our measurement now will consist of projecting actually onto the set of P lambdas. So that's a complete set of projectors. And the question is, if we get outcome lambda, what should we guess for our hat? Well, the trivial choice is the correct choice. You should guess that lambda bar is your spectrum. So here you have this diagram. And you measure that you got lambda, and so what you guess for R, right? You guess that you just renormalize, you just rescale them. So you just rescale the row length, and that's your spectrum. Okay. So then there is this little theorem by Kyle and Werner that make that precise, the statement. So so what did Kyle and Werner do? Well, Kyle and Werner said they computed this probability, right? So they took this measurement and they computed the probability that the lambda that they get given on the row is smaller than some polynomial factor times e to the minus n, and then just so I will forget about r hat now, right? R hat is just our lambda bar. That's just what we are guessing. So Kyle Werner say do that, right? So take your spectrum, take rho tensor n, measure it with this projective measurement, you get outcome lambda. What is the probability for that? Well, the probability for that decreases exponentially when your lambda bar is away from your spectrum. So let's draw a graph. So you obtain this outcome lambda bar, and you have your spectrum here. And what is here? I plot the probability of obtaining lambda. So what we do is what we get is like this. So this concentrates around this r, and the decay here is just this exponential function. So if you are an epsilon away from your center, this goes like e to the minus epsilon square half times n. Okay, so this becomes sharply peaked. So we see that our measurement is correct, and not only that it is correct, but that also decreases really nicely exponentially here. That's this theorem, so we can just do a three-line proof of it, because we have all the tools together now, almost. And how does the proof go? So we know we want to estimate this probability. So we're going to write it down. So what is P lambda rho tensor n? Well, P lambda rho tensor n Well, P lambda is the projector onto the unitary part and the projector onto the symmetric part, rho tensor n. What is that? That is the unless we've seen it. So here I can imagine, so instead of thinking about this as PU lambda tensor PV lambda, I can think of it as dimension V lambda copies of U lambda sitting inside here. And for each copy, actually, the value here is the same. So this is the same as dimension V lambda times. And then what is the trace of projector onto U lambda rho tensor N? So think for a moment that rho is not a density matrix, but an element from your group. Then this is actually just evaluating the character of this group element. Now, if you extend this character to all matrices, you just obtain that you get the character of this group element. So the character in the representation U lambda of this group element, and this group element, the character of an element only depends on the conjugacy class, which is the spectrum in this case. And so here, just our spectrum appears. And this function here, the character, is the Schur function, and we've seen Schur functions before, a little bit in Alan's lecture. So these Schur functions are very nice functions, and in particular, they have the property that the leading term in the Schur functions is R1 to lambda 1, R2, lambda 2, and so on. That's like the highest, that's the biggest term, RD, lambda D. That's the biggest term in the Schur function, and then there are some other terms. And these other terms, they're no more than dimension of the unitary group terms. So this here is smaller than dimension U lambda, dimension V lambda, times this this guy. So I will just write it like this, times this object. Okay, so we're almost there. Maybe I write it up here. Okay, so what is that? So dimension of this we had estimated was just a polynomial in N. The dimension of this we had estimated to 2 to the minus N. The Shannon entropy, let's write the Shannon entropy out immediately. So that was lambda I bar log lambda I bar. And then we have this. So we pull this also up in the log. So we take the log of this. So we take the log of this. And so that just gives plus the sum over I R, lambda I log R I. And notice that this lambda I was lambda I divided by N here. And, that lambda I bar is like this. So I can write this exponent as, okay, so this whole exponent, okay, so we'll do like this, is 2 to the minus n times bracket sum I log lambda I minus log ri. Okay, and now you have to believe me that this is actually bigger than lambda I minus ri, lambda bar squared. Okay. Sorry?
Move the left bracket in the exponent's two character positions to the right.
To
be the sum
over I outside the bracket, and then the first
lambda I outside the bracket, and then the opening bracket, log lambda I minus log r.
Oh, yeah.
Should
be bracket here.
Is there a reason why they don't just formulate it with
the
relative entropy?
No, they do with the relative entropy, but I didn't want to introduce this additional quantity here. Okay, so for me it was just important that you see that the decrease is like this. But it's true, they do formulate it with a relative entropy. They prove this is the optimal exponent. Good. So so this is actually the key point, right? So this little theorem is the key point, and everything else, so that was done by Karl and Werner. Everything else I still view as like a small corollary. And One thing, well, I have some minutes. So this theorem was discovered by many people, not only by Karl and Werner. So there are about 5 other papers I know where other people have discovered this in different contexts. So that seems to be kind of fundamental. And mathematicians kind of have a more precise version of this. And I just want to throw that at you. So they would say that the orbit of density matrices, the coordinate ring of the orbit of density matrices, can be decomposed into unitary in this way. Okay. So the coordinate ring of this can be decomposed into that. That somehow it's in some sense a more precise statement of this, although I don't really know how to derive Kyle Werner from that statement. Okay. So you see that there's, well, maybe you see that somehow there's some symplectic geometry going on and then some geometric invariant theory going on here. Okay? It's a little far-fetched, but there it is. Good. And the statement that I wrote down, this little statement for the physicists, maybe have seen the Peter Weyl theorem. This is kind of, you can view it as kind of a corollary of the Peter Weyl theorem. Somewhat, okay, or a generalization of it. Good. So now I want to tell you the simplest polytope. So I'm not sure if how well this polytope thing got across. So I want to give you my version of the polytope thing, which is, let's start with the Clebsch-Gordan transformation. Okay. So what is the Clebsch-Gordan transformation? Go back to square one, the Clebsch-Gordan transformation is J1 tensor J2, it's a sum over J's. Okay, so the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients are the coefficients in this matrix that brings you from here to here. But there is more information here, namely that the J's that can appear, they range from J1, from J going from J1 minus J2 to J1 plus J2. Okay? So let's plot that, okay? Let's just plot that. So let's plot the J's. So this is the J's, and here's J1 minus J2, and then I have steps, and here I have J1 plus J2. Okay. Now, and the steps here are of width 1, right? So each time you go one step up. Okay, now ramp up J, right? Ramp up these guys, like multiply them by N. Okay, consider N1 tensor NJ2 is whatever. And again, do again the same picture. And what you see, and rescale it, right? So rescale the thing to here. So here we draw now J1 plus J2 divided by, well, here we still draw J1 plus J2. Okay, and here J1 plus J2. Okay, and what you see is that the spacing here, of course, goes down to spacing 1 over N. Okay, now you increase this. What do you get? Okay. This is about the simplest polytope you could imagine. So that's your polytope, and that's a polytope that you can easily derive from the Clebsch-Gordan transformation you all learned in quantum mechanics. Now let's do a second polytope. Let's take a density matrix, a Hermitian matrix H1, and add it with a Hermitian matrix H2, and you fix the eigenvalues here, and you look at the spectrum. So you add spectra of Hermitian matrices which are in dimension 2. Okay? And you again plot the possible eigenvalues, so Horn's problem for dimension 2. You plot the possible eigenvalues so if the eigenvalue of this guy is alpha and of this guy the eigenvalues are beta, you plot the largest minus the smallest. So you define J1. Now I define J1 to be alpha 1 minus alpha 2, and I define J1 to be beta 1 minus beta 2, where that's the spectrum of the second operator. And then you can see that the possible spectra for the joint system also is here. This is not an accident. These two polytopes here are the same. Okay. And this is the simplest instance where you can see that these two polytopes are the same, and they are the same in a much more general setting. So, and when we talked about polytopes, the whole week, the simplest instance of this polytope was always that. Okay, so you hadn't seen this representation theory side of things, right? We had only talked about inequalities that bound this and this, but the inequalities can also be seen in this representation theoretic point of view over here. So let me tell you a theorem. Let me tell you a theorem that Graham and I came up some years back, and simultaneously it's also a corollary of Alexander Kloachko's work, but somewhat with completely different methods. So, and the theorem is the following. Plot, so you take your density matrices on a bipartite system, and you plot the possible spectra of the margins A and B. And we have talked the whole week about that this is going to be a polytope. If you do that for two qubits, the polytope looks exactly like this. Okay, so here, for two qubits, and this is normalized, the local margins have just one, I can just plot the maximum eigenvalue. So if I plot the maximum eigenvalue of the first margin up here, and I plot the maximum eigenvalue of the second margin over here, and I fix the spectrum of the overall thing to be lambda, right? I mean, you can think of lambda as 5 to 1, 0, right? It's 2 qubit, it's a spectrum, for instance, and you plot them, it looks like this. Okay. This is what Bravi discovered. And so, you can think of now the analog problem. So you take a representation of the unitary group, and of which unitary group? Of the unitary group of dimension A times dimension B. And you, right, this is from there, and you restrict it, and you decompose it according to its following, according to the product subgroup, and what you obtain is just a decomposition, just like the Clebsch-Gordan decomposition. Well, it is a Clebsch-Gordan decomposition. And you obtain this. This is from dA. This is from dB. And then there's a multiplicity with how often these guys appear. That's called G mu nu lambda. That's the so-called Kronecker coefficient. And so now you plot when these guys appear in here and when they don't. So when this Kronecker coefficient is 0 and when it's 1. You just plot that. And what you notice is that you get dots here. Okay. Okay, I have to wrap this out in the middle. Okay, so you get a grid of dots. And if you want to see a really nice print of this, you can have a look at Robert Sayer's poster out there, where he also shows a plot like this. So there's a grid in here. It's not really a nice grid. And there are some holes in the grid somewhere. Okay, so there are some holes in the grid. And so what Graham and I proved was that the two are equal, right? So this polytope that you get from plotting the density matrix spectra and the polytope that you got when you get these guys is the same thing when you ramp up n, right? So here we have a fixed spectrum. You plot the matrices. And here we kind of have a parameter, right? So we can increase the row length of this thing and have to rescale. So our grid, in each step the grid becomes denser, just like we did over here. If you take the limit, the two polytopes are the same. And my time is up, so I can't tell you how to prove this. Maybe a very sketch of how you prove it is the following way. Instead of doing Kyle Werner on one particle, you do Kyle Werner on two particles. So you take row AB, you throw it out of your machine, you throw out n copies, and you hammer half of these copies into your first measurement. So that's measurement of A, and then you have a measurement of B, and then you get an outcome, just we had before. And then just as before, we saw that you can only get outcomes that are related to the spectrum with high probability. And here you can only get pairs of outcomes that are related to the pair of spectra of the individual particles. And then somewhere in there, this decomposition shows up, and you get the relation to this Kronecker coefficient. Good. So, so we have now generalized this theorem a little bit. So if you think of like tilting this, and not only plotting when there is a Kronecker coefficient and when there isn't, but when considering the density of matrices that you have here. So if you draw them at random for the Mahar measure, the total one, you draw, plot the density here. So you can, yeah, you can imagine like some height function on here, and you plot the height of these Kronecker coefficients, which will be like some spikes here. You can also show that rescaled appropriately, this is the same thing. Good. Of course, this is also an incarnation of some geometric invariant theory problem. Namely, if you can view the marginal spectral problem as with, so the set of rho AB with fixed local spectra, you can view this, and you divide out by the subgroup. You can view this. This is a symplectic quotient, and you can view this as a GIT quotient, which will so that's our little subgroup U, dA cross U dB. So when you look at the invariant ring here, they can be identified. Okay, so that's like the big theorem, the big hammer from geometric invariant theory, which also gives you that little theorem. So my time is up. I haven't told you how Horn's problem is related to the spectral problem, so maybe we can do that later. I mean, who figured it out? Okay, you can ask me.